Please, good evening, everybody. Let's start with our motivation. Again, if we pause right now and think of all the different experiences that sentient beings are having at this very moment in all the different realms of existence, some of them suffering tremendously, some of them having great delight, but all of these situations being unsatisfactory because they're transient by nature and under the control of afflictions and karma. So instead of trying to tweak our samsara and make it better, let's give up that fruitless pursuit and set our aims for liberation. And not just thinking of liberation for ourselves alone, but remembering the kindness of all beings, remembering their unsatisfactory state, then let's strive for full awakening so that we can lead all of them out of cyclic existence and to full awakening. So to do that, we have to study the Dharma, and thus we're gathered together this evening. Okay, so how have we been doing tweaking our samsara, trying to make it a little bit better? Yeah? We've all been doing that, right? I want this comfortable situation. I don't want that uncomfortable situation. I deserve happiness here and now. I don't want suffering here and now. This isn't fair. Why is it happening to me? Everybody else has it better off. Right? Yeah. So if I just change this little circumstance, then everything would be good, and then I can change that circumstance, and that one, and that one. And suddenly we want to control everyone and everything to make it exactly the way we want it, so that we are 100% comfortable. Yeah? No discomfort. You ever succeeded in doing that?
It's no. Really
tiring.
Huh? It's really tiring.
It's very tiring. But we keep doing it, and we get very upset and angry at other people when they don't cooperate with us, right? Don't you realize I don't like this food? Don't you realize that I, you know, can't stand this and I can't stand that and I need this and I need that? And we get really upset and angry, you know, drive ourselves crazy, drive the people around us nuts. And it's all because of attachment, isn't it? It's all because of attachment, plain and simple. Trying to tweak our samsara, make it a little bit better. And in the process, we make ourselves actually more miserable, don't we? So then we go to the other extreme and we think, okay, well, I won't try and change anything. I'll just be a bump on the log. That's the definition of a good Buddhist. I'm just a bump on the log. Don't care about anything. Yeah, Do any of our teachers seem like bumps on a log? No. Yeah. Our teachers aren't like bumps on a log. So, you know, you're active and you think for yourself. Yeah. But the way we're active and the way we think for ourselves is going towards how to benefit living beings. Not going how to tweak our own samsara and make it better. Because that is really fruitless and exhausting and aggravating. Because we can't be successful. Yeah? So, better to give up the whole thing. My mother, yeah, I really think I should write a book on the sayings of my mother. Yeah? She used to say, don't knock your head against the wall. Not that I used to do that and she had to tell me not to. I wonder where that... Did any of your mothers say that? I wonder where that came.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? Huh?
Teacher said it, too.
So where
did... My mother actually did beat his head against the wall.
Your mother beat
him? My brother did.
Your brother?
Yeah, it was sort of his frustration outlet.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so knocking your head against the wall, who's going to win?
The wall.
The wall. Yeah? So why cause ourselves misery, you know, trying to get all the samsaric happiness we can get when we're never going to succeed? Yeah? And in the process become very aggravated and frustrated and confused. Yeah. So I remember my teachers always saying that if you wait until you have all the right circumstances to practice the Dharma, you're never going to practice. That all the bad circumstances are the situations you practice with. You don't try and tweak your samsara, make it perfect, and then you practice. It's when you're just living in samsara. Things aren't going the way you want. And dealing with those situations is your practice. Yeah, there's nothing other than that. Yeah, so we have to really understand that correctly. Otherwise, we really waste a lot of time and energy. Okay, so whatever's happening right now is our practice. And the thing is, if we can make our mind happy, then we can be happy no matter what's going on around us. Yeah. I read a lot about the Cultural Revolution in China. It was something that interested me, a lot of stories and people's biographies and so on. And you can see that the people who made it through the Cultural Revolution had a certain outlook on life that was different than the people who didn't make it through the Cultural Revolution. Yeah. And so it all depends on how you're thinking. Yeah? How you're thinking. And since the only thing we can ever really try and change is our own thoughts, let's put our effort into changing them and then, you know, become more flexible, more adaptable ourselves, less critical. Yeah. Then, you know, then we can be happy anywhere with anyone. Whereas when we're really finicky, we aren't happy anywhere with anyone. Okay, so we started last time chapter 9, right, which was about the general refutation of true existence by refuting permanent functional phenomena. Okay, so remembering that there's, in these last 8 chapters, we're going through a lot of refutations of a lot of wrong conceptions. You know, and all of them ultimately boil down to refuting inherent existence. But in the process, we have to refute even grosser concepts that are underlain by the grasping at true existence. Yeah. Because if we can't break through these grosser misconceptions, how are we ever going to break through the innate grasping at true existence? Okay, so that's why this chapter, we're, it's a general refutation of true existence by refuting permanent functional phenomena. So, you know, initially we hear permanent functional phenomena, you know, because we've studied the higher schools. Who would ever believe in that? Well, a bunch of non-Buddhists do, and the Vaivasikas do. Okay, because they define, sometimes they define permanent differently, sometimes they define functional and functional phenomena differently, yeah. And sometimes they just have plain old wrong ideas mixed in there. Yeah. For example, that something can be permanent and also be a cause. Yeah. But we, I mean, what's the idea of a creator? That is that idea, isn't it? You know, there's a creator who is permanent, who does not change, but who is the cause of everything. Yeah, so, I mean, it's right there in our own culture, and we probably believed in that. Yeah, except, you know, if you start analyzing it, how can something be permanent and still create? Yeah, because to create or to produce something means that something is changing. Nothing is... You can't create something out of nothing. There has to be something, and that something changes to become the effect. Yeah. So if something changes, it can't be permanent. Okay? So saying that there's a permanent creator or a permanent causal substance, you know, permanent cosmic substance out of which everything is created, you know, very easy to have this kind of idea, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Kind of, oh, there's substance that is holy and doesn't change, and out of it everything comes, and then when it ceases, it all dissolves back into that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it itself doesn't change. How is that possible? Yeah? Just spend some time with that. How is it possible for something to arise from a cause that doesn't change? Yeah? That's like saying that you have the cause and you can produce the result, but the cause is still there exactly as it was without changing. So you plant a seed in the ground, it produces a sprout, but the seed's still there. Yeah? So if that were the case, then, you know, you would never stop producing sprouts because the seed would always be there. So it could keep producing sprouts because it was permanent and didn't change, but it still could produce something. I mean, that's total nonsense, isn't it? But that's what you're reduced to saying if you say that there's a permanent cause that produces something. You get what I mean? Yeah, if it's a permanent cause, the cause is still there, even though the result came about. So that means cause and result exist at the same time. Is that possible? No. Why? Because the cause has to change to produce the result. Yeah. The cause doesn't change. There's no way you're going to get a result. You look perplexed.
Well, I'm puzzling over come we assume that if you hold that it's a cosmic substance, we assume that it's a permanent phenomenon? Like, I'm trying to play in my mind with what happens if the cosmic substance is changing moment by moment, but is always cosmic substance.
Yeah.
Something comes out, something goes back, of course it's changing moment by moment, it responds to the environment, it's a creative force.
Well, okay. Right? Yeah, so the problem was saying that there's an impermanent cosmic substance, is that if out of that, you know, you want to say it would be a pure cosmic substance.
No, of course.
Of course. But then, if it were pure, how does it produce kaka?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How does it produce anger?
Mm-hmm.
How does it produce all these impure, polluted things?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Out of purity, you can't produce something that's impure.
Gotcha.
Okay. So then you're stuck.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. There's this pure cosmic substance.
Yeah.
But out of it comes unhappiness.
Yeah.
What? You know, there has to be, you know, when things arise, they have to arise from a concordant cause.
Mm-hmm.
A concordant cause means a cause that's capable of producing it. Something that is pure cannot produce something that's impure. Okay. Yeah. It's real interesting when you start thinking about these things and different ideas that you've heard from different people here and there. You know, sometimes, you know, because we'll be talking about different ancient non-Buddhist systems here. Yeah, and I'm not going to go into a lot of depth about them and explain their whole, you know, cosmology. Number one, because I don't think it's fair to explain a system briefly. And number two, I don't understand some of them. So I think just to emphasize the important points in this section here. Okay. But then to see that some of the important points also apply to things that we're familiar with. Yeah. Okay, so verse 201. All are produced for their effects, thus none are permanent. There are no Tathagatas other than subduers who cognize things as they are. So this is refuting permanent functioning things in general. So we started this verse last time, so we didn't get too far. Okay, so last time we were talking about how in the world, in the world, it's assumed that in order to have a wage, then somebody has to work. Yeah. And so, in other words, things don't come by themselves causelessly. They aren't permanent. They don't inherently arise. They aren't truly existent. Yeah, they have to have a cause. And what's interesting here is that the reason that is refuting permanent functioning things is the same reason that is going to refute inherent existence. Even though permanent functioning things and inherent existence are different things. And the reason is because they arise due to causes. Okay? So if something arises and depends on causes and conditions, it can't be permanent. And if something depends on causes and conditions, it also can't exist inherently. Because inherent existence means independent existence. And independent is the opposite of dependent. So if something's dependent on causes and conditions, it can't be independent. So it can't be inherent. Okay? Yeah, so the Buddhas, due to their perfect knowledge of body, speech, and mind, directly know impermanence and emptiness and everything exactly as it is. And there's no other Tathagatas, you know, that can do that. So the Buddha said, whatever arises inevitably ceases, for aging and death are conditioned by birth. Right? So since arising or being produced leads to disintegration, arising is the cause of disintegration. Birth is the cause of death. Okay? So therefore, nothing lasts or exists by way of its own nature. You know, it's dependent on other things, so it's going to change. Okay? And then Gyatsabje talks a little bit here. You know, he gets into the Svatantrika thing, saying that, you know, there's some people who use autonomous reasons, well, not just the Svatantrikas, but others too, to refute permanence and true existence. To refute permanence and true existence, that's only the Svatantrikas who would use them to refute that. But Prasangikas disagree, saying that there's no commonly appearing objects. So the thing is that, you know, according to the Svatantrikas, things exist inherently. So when you look at the package of tissues, you know, your mind that sees inherently existent package of tissues is a reliable cognizer. Okay? So it perceives the nature of this, the tissues, exactly as they are, inherently tissues. From the Prasangika viewpoint, that mind that sees inherently existent tissues, yeah, it is a reliable cognizer of the tissues, but it's not a reliable cognizer of inherently existent tissues, because inherently existent tissues don't exist at all. And that conventional valid cognizer that can ascertain tissues, yeah, it's a reliable cognizer, but it is mistaken, yeah, because the object it's apprehending appears truly existent, even though it isn't. Okay, so when the Svatantrikas use autonomous syllogisms, if they say, you know, that the tissues are not truly existent because they're produced by causes, when they say the tissues, they're talking about these tissues that appear inherently existent to us. They say they aren't truly existent because they're product of causes. Yeah. But the Prasangikas say, no, you can't say that the subjects of the syllogism are the inherently existent tissues that we're looking at, because inherently existent tissues don't exist. They can't be the subject of syllogism. So you can't say that there's commonly appearing objects for both, you know, us and you, because we, you know, the fact is that we disagree about how the subject of the syllogism exists, and that's why we're debating to start with. Okay? Yeah? So this is like a very detailed debate when you get into the whole thing, you know, between Buddha Palita and Bhava Viveka. This is one of the things that they were arguing about. Yeah. The subject of the syllogism, you know, does it appear, you know, in the same way to both people? Is it, do we agree on the way the subject of the syllogism exists before we even start debating? And the answer is no. Okay, from the Prasangika viewpoint. Okay? So the Prasangikas say that all the conventional, reliable cognizers of sentient beings are mistaken, because things appear truly existent even though they aren't. And the only reliable cognizers of sentient beings that are unmistaken are the meditative equipoise on emptiness that directly perceives emptiness. That's the only unmistaken cognizer of a sentient being. And of course, those you only get path of seeing and up. Okay? So, remember I was saying before that we have to get used to being wrong? Yeah? Well, here's lesson number one, you know. Everything we perceive is mistaken because it doesn't exist inherently in the way that it appears to exist. Okay. Well, this is a good reason not to get too arrogant. Mm-hmm. Yeah, whenever we start getting a little bit puffed up, to sit and say, well, all of my cognizers are mistaken. Yeah, so what am I so puffed up about? Okay, so even though, from the Prasangika viewpoint, even though these objects are reliable, they're also, even though these cognizers, conventional cognizers, are reliable, they're also mistaken. However, when you have a conventional cognizer that sees a snake as a rope, or sees a rope as a snake, that is not just mistaken, it is erroneous. Okay? Because, you know, you're just totally mistaken about what the object is. And if you look, you know, start noticing how many times a day that you have just even a wrong cognizer. You know, like I notice, like if I look at green and then I look at something white, I see red. You know, that's wrong cognizer, isn't it? Yeah, there's no red spot there. Yeah, sometimes we hear one thing and we didn't hear it correctly. Yeah, or we see something, we think it's other than what it is. You see a turkey and you wonder if it's a goose. Yeah. If your eyes aren't so good and you're looking from a distance. Yeah.
You hear the new squeaking of the door in Shenzhen, it sounds like someone making noise.
Yeah, the squeaking door, you know, I thought somebody was crying. Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, good examples of wrong consciousnesses. Okay. Verse 202, there is not anywhere anything that ever exists without depending. That's something we should probably memorize. There is not anywhere anything that ever exists without depending. Thus, never is there anywhere anything that is permanent. So here he's refuting, the Vaisheshikas, that's a non-Buddhist school, they say that although things that are produced for their effects aren't permanent, okay, functional things from space to the mind, which are neither produced nor producers, and the smallest particles, which are producers but not produced, are permanent and truly existent. Okay, so this is why we're not going to get too much into their philosophy, because it would take a lot to try and understand. But basically, okay, they say, things that are produced for their effects aren't permanent. They say that. But then they turn around and say functional things, and they say from space to the mind. So from space to the mind refers to things that the Vaisheshikas considered to be substances, like the four elements, time, direction, self, you know, these kinds of things. And they say that those things are neither produced, so they're not effects, nor producers, nor are they causes. Okay.
And what are they?
They're permanent functional things. Okay. And they also say that the smallest particles, which produce other things, but they themselves are not produced, you know, which is something that, you know, in the West, scientists were looking for. The ultimate smallest particle that never changes, that's permanent, right? Okay. So they say that those things are permanent and also truly existent, you know.
Who say that?
The Vaisheshikas? That, no, non-Buddhist. Yeah? The non-Buddhist school. But if you look, you know, in our mind, we may be looking too, if we break down all, you know, things to molecules, to atoms, to electrons, to subatomic particles, to smaller quarks, and I don't know all the little things they're finding, then eventually we're going to find something that is the smallest particle, yeah, that never changes and that exists by itself without depending on anything else. And yet, if you put a bunch of those together, you get everything around us. You know? I mean, that's something that I think people, many scientists are looking for. Okay? So, you know, this is the kind of thing that's getting refuted, because if you had, like, these tiny particles that were permanent, that existed in and of themselves, then they would not depend on any other thing. Yeah. So then they could never join together with other particles. They could never change to form a whole. But we have this idea of all these unchanging permanent things, and we just get them together, and they still don't change when they're put together. They're exactly the same as they were before, but they produce something new. Yeah? Really? They don't change, but, you know, you put enough things together and you get something new that happens to be impermanent and changing. Yeah? And yet, you know, if you look inside, it's like, well, you know, somebody could probably convince me of those kind of smallest things. You know, it sounds kind of cool, doesn't it?
Like building out of Legos.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Yeah.
Building out of what?
Legos.
Legos?
The yeah. Elastic things.
Yeah, right. But Legos are big.
Yeah.
But still,
yeah.
You just
yeah.
The idea
oh, okay.
They're all the same, they don't change, but you can put them together in all different combinations.
Oh, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, yeah, we'll just ignore the fact that the Legos are big. We'll just say they're all the same and they don't change, and yet you can put them together and get something new. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense, until you start thinking about it. Huh? Okay. So never in any time or place can you find a functional phenomena that is independent and unrelated. In fact, you can't even find a non-functional phenomena, i.e. a permanent phenomena, that is independent and unrelated. Okay, so everything that exists dependently does not exist by its own nature. 203, there is no functional thing without a cause, nor any permanent which has a cause. Thus the one who knows suchness said, what has come about causelessly does not exist. Okay, so now we're going to get into refuting permanent functional things more individually. And here we're talking about refuting a permanent self. Okay. So, you know, here's the Vaisheshikas again. They're saying dependently arisen phenomena like pleasure exist, and the self that is the cause that attracts them. And the self is the cause that attracts them. Thus, the self exists, and the self is also permanent. Yeah. See, it has to do somehow with how they frame these different categories of phenomena, and the self, the, you know, that pleasure is dependently arising, but the self is permanent and it attracts the pleasure that's dependent. But how can a self that's permanent experience pleasure? Because experiencing pleasure or pain means you have to change. Okay? So, you know, we respond, there's no personal self since one, that which has no producing cause is not a functional phenomena. Okay? So, according to our school, functional phenomena is synonymous with impermanent. It means something that's produced by a cause. And it serves, it performs the function of producing an effect. Okay, that's what functional phenomena means, according to our school. And second of all, there's no permanent personal self, because there's not anything permanent that has a cause. So the first part, when it says that which has no producing cause is not a functional phenomena, in other words, it's the self does have a cause, it can't be a functional phenomena, okay, according to this school. Yeah. And, wait a minute, no. If the self doesn't have a cause, it can't be a functional phenomena. Okay. And if it does have a cause, it can't be permanent. So either way you look at it, how can you have a permanent functional phenomena? Okay? Because if you said the self, yeah, if it doesn't have a cause, then how can it be a functional phenomena? Something without a cause cannot produce an effect. Okay? So that's negating the functional part of it. Okay? But by saying it doesn't have a cause, if it doesn't have a cause, it can't be a functional phenomenon. But if it does have a cause, then it can't be permanent, because anything that has a cause is impermanent. So there's no way you can put, you know, something together that, like a self, that is a permanent functional phenomena. Yeah. And the Buddha, who knows suchness, says phenomena that arise causelessly don't exist. So think about that. Think of a phenomena that arises without a cause. Yeah? So this is, you know, the whole idea behind a creator. And I remember as a kid thinking about that. You know? That if every, you know, because everything that supposedly the creator created, you can see was produced by causes. Yeah? So how can the creator be permanent? Yeah? It can't. And if you say that things were created without any cause, that the Creator created things without any cause, then that would be saying also the Creator isn't the Creator, because it would be saying the Creator isn't the cause of the creation. But then it would be saying out of nothing you can have something appear. There's total non-existence, and within total non-existence, something appears. Well, in the cartoons, that's true. Yeah? You know, in cartoons, you have nothing, and then, boing, something appears. Yeah? But, yeah, in reality, can something come into existence without there being a cause for it? Without there being something that existed prior to it that made it come into existence. Yeah. It can't be, because if something could be, you know, could come into existence without a cause, then, you know, anything could come into existence at any time whatsoever. Yeah. And the whole system of causality would fall apart, because results could come without causes. So you could be full without eating, you could, you know, fly in the sky without, you know, although you weigh 2 tons, you know, things could happen without causes, and that's totally contradictory to our experience. Okay? So what happens in cartoons doesn't happen in reality. Yeah.
But what happens with the argument that, okay, God made it, God's breath, God breathed it, who made God? Well, okay, so there's the question, but then what's the cause of consciousness? Beginningless.
The previous moment.
Right, so maybe the previous moment of God is also beginningless.
But they don't...
I know they never say that. But,
yeah.
But it's like it kind of there is this place where it boils down to me, like, but, how do you refute that?
But if the previous moment of God, mm-hmm. you know, God exists and there was the previous moment of God, then God can't be permanent.
Yeah.
So how can you assert a permanent creator?
Right.
Because that's part of the whole thing. God is permanent. God doesn't depend on anything else. If God is impermanent, then God depends on causes and conditions. Right, just like everybody else, and God forbid that. Yeah. So God, that, you know, you can't assert a God that's impermanent, that can be influenced by causes and conditions, because then it's just like everything else. Okay. So consciousness, you know, there's always a previous cause. And even with matter, there's always some kind of previous cause. And then you get somebody who says, but what's the beginning of the causes? And they, what can you say? There's no beginning. And they say, well, there has to be one. And you say, who says? Why does there have to be a beginning?
How could there be a beginning?
Exactly. How could there be a beginning? And here's the point, at the point where I give the example of the number line, because either direction in the number line, you can always add one more or subtract one more. And when are you ever going to reach the end of the number line? It's like if you look out into the universe. I used to do this when I was a kid, you know, lie down and look into space and wonder where space ended, and realizing that space couldn't end, because if you got to the end of space and there was a brick wall there, you know, that's the end of space, then there must be something on the other side of the brick wall. And you could go through the wooden wall into the other side. Yeah, that's what I used to do too. Yeah, like where does, and you can't find an end. Yeah, there isn't one. Yeah. So for some people, that becomes very scary. The fact that there's no beginning and no end is really scary. You know, for me, I just thought it was really cool. You know? Did you think it was cool when you did that?
You know, actually, I would imagine it as this wooden wall with a hole, and then you look to the other side, and it'd be like whatever color it was, and then my mind would just go, and what do you do with that? And I just kind of stop it there.
Yeah. Like, yeah, there's just another infinity on the other side. Yeah. Okay, then 204. If the unproduced is permanent, because impermanent things are seen to be products, seeing that the produced exists would make the permanent non-existent. Let's see if we can figure out what that means. So if seeing that the sprout and pleasure, we're still talking about the Vaisheshikas, if seeing that the sprout and pleasure are impermanent and they arise, you assert that the self and other things are by implication permanent, yeah, it would follow that because of seeing a sprout arise or be produced and exist, whatever is permanent like the self should be non-existent like a sky flower. So here they're saying that, you know, if it exists, it's got to be caused and it's got to be impermanent. Therefore, you know, if it's permanent, how can it exist at all? Yeah. So your whole idea of a self is, you know, yourself would be non-existent. Okay? So seeing that the produced exist and are caused and are impermanent contradicts their assertion that there are permanent functional things. Okay? So in that case, all these permanent things would be non-existent. So if you say the self is a permanent functional thing, then if you say functional things, functional phenomena exist, since they are impermanent, then permanent things would not exist, and thus the self would not be exist. Okay, so if you change your mind and you said functional things exist and are impermanent, yeah, then for these schools you would say that permanent things don't exist, and so then you would have to say that the self wouldn't exist. Okay? So if produced meant existence, then permanent functional things would be non-existent because they are produced. 205. That space and so forth are permanent is a conception of common beings. For the wise, they are not objects perceived even by a valid, conventional, reliable cognizer. Okay, so here we're moving into the Vibhasikas, which is a Buddhist school. So you remember when we were studying the Vibhasikas that they talked about there were three substantially existent unconditioned phenomena. Remember that? There was space, analytical cessation, and non-analytical cessation. Remember those? Mm-hmm. And so they were asserted to be permanent, but substantially existent. Okay. And functioning things. Because remember that for the Vibhasikas, functioning things, the function doesn't mean being able to function to produce an effect. It means function to allow something to happen. So space, even though it's a negative phenomena, the absence of obstructability, functions to allow things to exist in it. So therefore, the Vibhasikas say it's a functioning thing. Whereas the other Buddhist schools say, no, it's not a functioning thing, because functioning means that it functions to produce an effect, and if it produces an effect, that it itself also has to have a cause. Okay, so we're refuting the Vibhasikas here. Okay, so just to remember that space was the absence of obstructability, and space exists everywhere, including where there are obstructing objects. Because if there wasn't a nature of a lack of obstructability, these obstructing objects could not exist in that space. Okay. And then, so we agree, you know, with the Vibhasikas, yes, you know, space is permanent, but we don't say it's substantially existent, and we don't say it's a substance. You know, and for them, you know, saying it's substantially existent is right on the slippery slope down to truly existent. Okay? So, because the Vibhasikas say existent, knowledge object, and thing are synonymous. Is thing synonymous with knowledge object? Why not?
Because thing is synonymous with functional thing, and there are permanent knowledgeable.
Right. Knowledge. Yeah. Because thing means functional thing, and everything that exists isn't a functional thing. There's permanent things as well. Okay. So that's important to remember. Thing is not synonymous with object, because thing is referring to functioning things, things that arise due to causes and produce effects. Okay?
An object?
An object it just means existent. Object, knowledge, object, phenomena is all synonymous with existent. So it refers to everything, that all phenomena that exist, whether they're permanent or impermanent. Okay?
So, they say common people don't understand the significance of using the term space to indicate a mere absence of obstructive contact. It's a mere absence. There's nothing positive is being asserted. Okay? So, but to Vaibhasikas, perform a function doesn't mean produce an effect, as it does for the other schools. For them, it just means allow something to happen. Okay? So, they not only define function in functional thing different, but they also say that permanent things are substance and are substantially existent. Yeah? And so that's, you know, we really disagree. Okay, then the other thing, individual analytical cessations, okay, that's the other, another type of permanent phenomena, okay, and so that is a separation from pollution. In other words, a separation from afflictions that attain through analyzing the Four Noble Truths individually. So in other words, it's a true cessation. It's, you know, because you have analyzed the Four Noble Truths, yeah, then you have been able to cease the existence of an affliction, for example, in such a way that it will never come back. So that that cessation of the affliction is permanent. It never changes. The affliction has ceased. That's it. Yeah? It can never come back, and that cessation never changes. Whereas a non-analytical sensation is just the cessation of something because the causes for it don't come together. Okay, the analytical cessation is you've eliminated the causes in such a way that they can never appear. That something can never appear. So you've eliminated the afflictions through analysis in such a way that the afflictions can never appear. So that cessation is the analytical one. The non-analytical one is you're sleeping, so your anger, hopefully, yeah, unless you're dreaming, maybe you're dreaming, but let's say you're in deep sleep, okay? So there's a cessation of your anger at that moment, but that's a non-analytical cessation. It's just that the causes and conditions for your anger haven't come together. So there's an absence of the anger in that moment, and that absence is permanent in the sense that the absence itself doesn't change. However, when the causes and conditions come together for being angry, you're angry. Okay? Another example they give of a non-analytical cessation is when bodhisattvas attain the fortitude or patience level of the path of preparation. There's four stages of the path of preparation. So it's the fortitude is, the third? Yeah, it's the third one. Okay, so at that time, when you reach the fortitude stage, then there you automatically have an analytical cessation with respect to the aggregates of the lower realms, in the sense that once you attain that stage on the path of preparation, you are never again reborn in the lower realms. And that is because there's no way for the causes and conditions to come together. So it's a non-analytical sensation. Just the causes and conditions cannot come together. When you attain the path of seeing, then, you know, you can never be reborn in the lower realms. You know, and that's because you've realized emptiness directly and, you know, the causes for the lower rebirth have been eliminated in such a way that they can never appear again. Yeah. So this is an interesting thing to think about. Yeah. A cessation which is the lack of something because you've eliminated the causes for it permanent, you know, forever, and a cessation, a lack of something that is just the lack of it because the causes and conditions haven't come together. Both of them are a lack of something. And in that way, you know, how can you really differentiate them? Yeah. But because they come about in quite different ways, yeah, then they're actually very different. Okay. So for me, when I, you know, thinking about that helps to understand, you know, when they're talking about how bodhisattvas attain all these true cessations, you know, on the path as they go up, that that the wisdom realizing emptiness is the same. The emptiness realized is the same. The true cessations are said to be an emptiness, but the true cessations, you know, are not exactly the same on each level of the path, because they're the analytical cessations of different things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's in this way when you look at, okay, the absence of inherent existence of an ordinary being's mind and the absence of inherent existence of a Buddhist mind are exactly alike. You know, from the perspective of perceiving that absence of inherent existence, you cannot differentiate them. Okay? But from the perspective of what they're the emptiness of, there's a big difference between being the emptiness of a sentient being's mind and being the emptiness of a Buddha's mind. Yeah? Because the sentient being's mind is polluted and the Buddha's mind isn't. Yeah? So these absences, these emptinesses, from one perspective, from the perspective of perceiving emptiness directly, they're the same. But from the perspective of what they're the emptiness of, they're different. Yeah? And that's why we have to practice the path and purify the mind to eliminate the afflictions. Yeah? Okay. So both of these kinds of cessation are described in the first chapter of the Abhidharmakosha, which was written by Vasubandhu, who was the brother of Asanga, who wrote, Abhidharma Sayacharya, the compendium of knowledge. What else did Asanga write?
The
hearer's stages, the bodhisattva stages, the Yogacharya Bhumi. Yeah. And Asanga was a disciple of
Maitreya.
And
channeled all those Maitreya texts too.
Yes, mm-hmm. Right. Brought all the Maitreya texts down from the God realm here. Okay.
And so I just wanted to check.
Mm-hmm.
So then this emptiness of the Buddha mind, mm-hmm, is the Buddha jewel.
Is the nature Dharmakaya.
The nature Dharmakaya.
Okay. Yeah. The wisdom Dharmakaya is a functional phenomena.
Okay.
It changes.
Right.
Okay.
Why it say that, you know, the teachings come from Maitreya?
Mm-hmm.
The Buddhism was not established when Asanga received the teachings from Maitreya. The Buddhism was not.
Well, the Buddha taught everything, but then in terms of the lineage, one lineage went through Maitreya to Asanga, and then down that way. And that's the lineage that teaches bodhicitta, and that teaches the citta-madra, or mind-only view. And then there's another lineage that also the Buddha taught that comes through Nagarjuna, and those are the teachings on emptiness.
Would you say that Maitreya received the teaching from the
There's different ways, you know. Some people, say that, you know, Maitreya is in the God realm, in the Tushita realm right now, because he's going to be the next Buddha. And so he's living in the Tushita realm now. This is the story, yeah. And so he's, you know, already enlightened, but living in the Tushita realm, ready to appear on the earth. But then many people say that Maitreya was a human being. So, depends how you look at Maitreya. Am I answering your question?
Sangha lived after the Buddha. Lived after the Buddha, and he got the teachings from Maitreya.
Well, that's the thing. Some people say Maitreya was a human being. Some people say Maitreya is a Buddha who's living in the Tushita realm until it comes time for him to manifest here.
Okay, but when Asanga was living, it's not that he has to receive the teachings from Maitreya because the teachings was not
In the world. Oh, yeah. It seems that way from the story that talks about that. There's a story that says Asanga went to the God realm and studied with Maitreya, and he studied 50 years with Maitreya, but it was only the length of one morning in the God realm, and then he brought back Maitreya's text down to this earth. So that's how the story goes. Yeah. Whether it's true or not, I have no idea. Okay. So.
Sangha lived in what, 400?
300. No, 3rd century. 3rd century. Yeah. And early 4th. Yeah.
These are like stories about how he learned what he learned.
Yeah. Yeah, the tradition has a lot of these kind of supernatural stories about how the teachings appeared on the earth. So you can believe them literally, you cannot. It's up to you. I think the important thing is to understand the teachings. Yeah, how they got here, I don't really care personally. You know, it doesn't matter to me whether Nagarjuna went to the Naga realm and got the Prajnaparamita Sutras, you know. Whether Nagarjuna, 600 years, I'm not going to lose my faith if he didn't. You know, I think it's much more important to learn the teachings. And when you learn the teachings, you see how brilliant they are. And then your faith comes from that. Yeah. The way I look at it, if my faith came because of these kind of stories, there would be no reason for me to become a Buddhist, because every religion has these kind of stories. Yeah, doesn't it? Every religion has some kind of supernatural stories about how their teachings and their founder came about. Yeah. So.
You said that the different schools, there's like an evolution, a more subtle ways of see the reality.
Mm. Yeah.
And I have the doubt, it's not that the Buddha. From the first time taught the correct
view. Oh, yes, yes. The Buddha taught the correct view right from the beginning. And the Buddha, while he was alive, he taught all these different tenet systems, these different philosophical systems. Okay? he taught all these different things because not everybody thinks in the same way. So he had to teach different things to fit the dispositions and the capacities of different living beings. But, you know, if you look at all the different things the Buddha taught, you can also see that, you know, because, and they're taught for different beings with different capacities, that you can see some of them are easier to understand and they really are closer to our present way of looking at things. And then other ones are more and more difficult to understand. So they're placed in that order, you know, like if you, they show a more and more refined view of reality. But the Buddha taught all of those while he was alive. So it's not a chronological order. It isn't that the Buddha taught this and then, you know, he didn't teach these other teachings and they had to come from somewhere else later on, afterwards. Yeah, it's not like that. Okay. Yeah.
First, on 201 says, there are no tathagatas other than Sakyua. Shouldn't it be other than the Sakyua who cognize things as they are? Did the Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha cognize the things as
yes.
they are?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, all the Buddhas.
Yeah.
If you're a Buddha, you all of them cognize the same things, and they all cognize things as they are. You know, well, it depends. It can, you know, sometimes you use the word Buddha referring to the Buddhas. Sometimes you use Buddhas referring to all the Buddhas. In this case, it could be either one. Yeah. Okay. Maitreya came. Sitting on the chair, yes.
She was trying to be here earlier, but since she wouldn't stay, so we'd put her place.
Yeah.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Idam
Guratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west floor.